The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
But it's lovely to be back in Sydney. It'll be good to be back in Canberra later today. Speaking about Edwin Judge and great professors, there's a great professor called Professor Richard Borkham from Aberdeen University, one of the great universities from the UK, and he particularly is world famous for his studies on the Gospels and Jesus. And it's interesting when someone notes something that you think surely someone should have noticed that before, but he's noticed in a way that I haven't heard anybody else bring up, that there are occasionally in the Gospels where someone is mentioned by name. Nicodemus in chapter 3 is one. The woman we're going to look at today is not named. Lazarus, Mary and Martha are named. Bartimaeus is named. But the overwhelming number of people who interact with Jesus in the Gospels or who are healed by Jesus are never named. But then occasionally, guys get named. And Borkham has done quite a bit of work in this, the professor, and he says it's fairly clear that the reason why some are named is because they became members of the Jerusalem church. So they were known. So when John and Mark and these guys would write the Gospels, they knew these guys. And almost certainly they would have heard Nicodemus tell his story of when he first met Jesus and the time when he spoke up in the Sanhedrin and spoke. Because it is peculiar the people who don't get named and those that do. And Borkham, I think, has hit upon the most likely reason for that. And you may know that he's actually traced who he thinks Nicodemus is from the great Ben-Gurion family that was around then and now has an airport named after him. We come now to this passage in chapter 4. And some people have, in this sort of overly sensitive way, have said, see how this woman is marginalized. Nicodemus is named. She's not named. She's just a faceless woman. That is such rubbish. There must be a more scholarly and polite way to say that. She's just like so many of the other key figures in the Gospel who don't get named. There's a blind guy in chapter 9, gets a whole chapter devoted to him and Jesus, and he's just the blind guy. We don't get his name. It's not as if the blind are now being marginalised. He just didn't become part of the church. One of the things that I mustn't go on about is the extraordinarily totally positive view, say, that John has of women. So he has a number of stories of men who have come out quite badly with Jesus, but the women are extraordinarily positively told. So this woman here in John 4, who comes out of this so much better than Nicodemus, she really comes out magnificently and becomes, as we'll see in 2 weeks' time, an outstanding example in the whole of the Gospels of a particular important bit of Christian living. This woman does it in a way that nobody else does it. In fact, she does it in a way that shames the apostles in the same chapter. But then we have Martha, who comes up with the great profession of faith of Jesus. We have Martha's sister, Mary, who anoints Jesus' feet with oil just beforehand, and the disciples grumble about the waste of money. It's the women who are there at the death of Jesus. It's Mary who gets appeared to. The way in which Jesus, there's no doubt that the church, like every single human institution, engaged in, you know, patriarchal marginalizing of women, etc., and misrepresents women. That's what human societies do, sadly, and men do. But the Gospels themselves, and Jesus himself, is extraordinarily positive about women. And this woman is like that, although she's nameless. We don't know her name. She's just, as some know her, as she's the fattest woman in the Bible, because she's, sorry about that, that's a sad joke, isn't it? Because she's the woman of Samaria. So, and you want to write that joke down? It's an absolute winner. There's a series of them, but I'll restrain myself out of love for neighbour. Now, I've suggested this is a meeting of two thirsty people, and it is. We meet Jesus here. He's just walked maybe 30, 40 kilometres. We're not sure exactly, but he's walked quite a way. It's hot. It's the middle of the day, and we're told in verse 4, now Jesus had to go to Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. So Jesus himself is quite obviously needy. He is weary, we're told, from the long walk. The sixth hour is midday, so it's the hottest part of the day. So he's physically weary. The disciples have gone off to get some food, we're told in verse 8, so he's presumably hungry. And when this unspeakable outcast of a woman comes, he's so desperate he asks her for a drink. So Jesus is weary, hungry and thirsty, and he's waiting for his mates to get back with the food from the local town. Now at this point, as some of you may know, if you've had friendly discussion with, say, Muslims or Jehovah's Witnesses who think quite similarly at this point, they'll say, you see, Jesus is not what you Christians say he is, because he's weary, he's thirsty, he's a man. Because, as you might know, people seem to have trouble even understanding what Christians have classically said about Jesus. Not just that he is God and not man, but that he is thoroughly man, totally, really, truly man. Stick the nails through his wrists and he would have screamed out in pain. He gets thirsty, he gets hungry, he goes to the bathroom, he sweats, etc., etc. He probably made maths mistakes when he was a kid, but we can argue about that over coffee at the end. He was a human. And he was God. So I'm just surprised how often my Jehovah's Witness contacts in the past, haven't talked to him for a couple of years, and Muslim friends have said to me, this sort of thing is proof that he's not God. It's just not. So the Christian point of view has always been, he's thoroughly, truly, totally man. He gets weary, he gets tired, he gets lonely, he gets anxious at times, he gets fearful at times. He's a real human being like you and I. And he is more. 100% of both. So we've got a needy Jesus meets this woman. She's obviously needy because she's brought her great big jar to get water from the well at the wrong time of day. At this point, we're engaging in speculation. She's come to the well to get water, that's clear, so she's needy too. Why has she come in the middle of the day? Or that's not when women in these cultures get water. They get water in the morning and especially in the evening when it's cool. And they come as a gaggle, as a group, to lessen the pain. That she comes in the middle of the day on her own is probably because she's already an outcast. Because she's much more than just a Samaritan woman. She's a Samaritan woman, as you heard, who's had five husbands and is now living with a guy. Now, in our culture, that's just mildly interesting. In that culture, it's an extravagant case of sexual sinfulness. I mean, even if the five husbands all died, and frankly, who would line up to be number 3, 4, and 5 if the first two had died? But that doesn't seem to be likely. The fact that she's in a de facto relationship with a guy is shocking in a Jewish culture, in a Samaritan culture. So she's almost certainly an outcast before she comes, and she meets Jesus, who's a Jew. She knows he's a Jew by the clothes he wears and by the way that he speaks. There's no doubt about that. And so she meets Jesus, not having the faintest clue who he is. And then Jesus shows that he's needy by saying, "Will you give me a drink?" Verse 9. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew. I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" And then John gives the explanatory note, "For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." In other contexts, we've looked at the extreme, almost unimaginable hatred and loathing there was between the Samaritans and the Jews. Won't go through all that again. Just to remind you, though, that even the shadow of a Samaritan on a drinking utensil of a half-decent Jew would mean he would never use that to drink again. They considered even the shadow of a Samaritan to be filthy and unclean, to make something unusable, like some sort of deadly infection. So she's rightly surprised. She's going, "What? What are you thinking? You're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan, I'm a woman," which in that culture means I'm another step down. And we're going to discover, as you heard in the reading, Jesus knows she's not just a Samaritan woman, she's a Samaritan woman who is unspeakably successful in the area of moral sin and sexual failure. So Jesus has got all that under control. So she's surprised, but Jesus then furthers her surprise in verse 10. Jesus seems to show complete ignorance of the prejudices and the social mores and the barriers that any half-decent human being would have lived by and kept the wheels of everything ticking over. He jumps right across all those barriers, as he still does. Verse 10, Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is asking you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water?" Now just notice what Jesus says there in verse 10. He says, "Lady, you're a bit surprised, are you, that I've asked for the water? Let me tell you something. If you only knew who was talking to you, you'd be asking me and I would be giving you living water, those bubbling..." It's one of these... It's a bit like Jesus does this a few times in John's Gospel, where he will use a word that's got a couple of levels of meaning. This word can just mean, living water can just mean water that's moving, or it can have sort of a more, you know, the water that brings life, that is deeply refreshing. The Old Testament speaks of God giving living water for people, bursting out of the temple. So he says, "Lady, you don't know who's talking to you. You see me as a Jew, well done. You see me as a man, well done, I am, obviously. But you don't see who I really am. If you did know who I was, you would be asking me." So he says, so he goes from him asking her for real water, which he needs. I don't think he ever gets it in the story, because she ends up running back to her village. She's so excited about what she discovers. But so he remains thirsty. But he says, "Lady, you don't get who's talking to you, and you don't get what I would like to give you. I'd like to give you some water, some living water." She says, "What are you talking about? We're going to get this from you. You've got nothing." Verse 12, "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well?" So Jesus raised the question, "You don't know who I am." She says, "Can you be greater than Jacob, one of the great founding fathers of Israel?" Absolutely, Jesus is going to say. And then he really, I think, gives us the great moment of insight, perhaps, in verse 13. He doesn't stop to interact on some of the stuff she raises. Verse 13, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water that I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water that I give will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." Now here Jesus, I think, gives us some sort of clarity, but even here I think it's still a bit mysterious. He says, "Lady, we're talking about two different sorts of waters. We're talking about two different sorts of thirst and need." Because one of the things about human beings is that we are, from birth and by design, thirsty, needy, dependent creatures. One of the illusions, and I think particularly men struggle with this, is we long for and have the illusion of independence. Emotional independence, financial independence. Also, we don't like to feel we need other people. But you're born needy and dependent, crying for milk, longing for cuddles. This is what little human beings need. And you are completely dependent on oxygen. Any notion that we are independent only means we haven't thought long enough on water. If there's an absence of bathrooms, we're in all sorts of bother. We are deeply dependent creatures. We're needy. You are a needy little person. All of us are needy. And Jesus is talking about physical water. He said, "If you drink this water again, you'll get thirsty again." But he said, "I have water to give, the water of life, that will spring up within you on the inside, the water that will lead to eternal life." Jesus is talking about his two different human needs. If you don't have bread and water, and Jesus will go in a few paragraphs time and he'll have a conversation about food. The woman gets confused about the water. He's going to talk with his disciples about food. They get confused about food because they keep thinking of it in terms of the physical sense, and he's using that as a picture of a deeper thirst that you and I have. If you don't have water and food, your body will in the end malfunction and you'll get sick and you'll die. If you don't have this other water, if you don't have these other needs met, you will malfunction and ultimately ruin yourself. And Jesus says, "I can give you. I am the source of water, of that which will satisfy your heart." So in chapter 7, Jesus says, "Is anyone thirsty? Let him come to me and drink." And in chapter 6, he says, "I am the bread of life. Are you hungry? Come to me and eat." Jesus is constantly portraying himself as the one source of that which deeply, truly perfectly enduringly satisfies the heart needs that human beings have. And the ad that Peter sent out talked about the two ticks and a dog. It's an idea I've heard from a learned man from the United States of America. And he said that in all of our relationships, particularly loving relationships, we go in seeking to have some of our needs met. And the problem is that we're all trying to get our needs met. And at that point, we're like ticks, noble animals that they are. Ticks need a host. They need something they can put their little fangs into and get their needs met. If you have two ticks without a dog, and they sort of embed their fangs into each other, it's not, the system's not going to work. Because in the end, I think what Jesus is suggesting is you need to get your thirst met outside yourself. You need to be, well, as in the end, it's a God thing. Your deepest needs can only be met ultimately and well and healthily by God. Now, you can get all sorts of substitutes, as I think this woman does. I think that's why we're going to get to her husband soon. But Jesus is saying, it's me that you need. You've made with needs, and I'm the one who can satisfy. Here he's, of course, putting himself in the place of God. Let me read you some, just two classic parts from the Old Testament. This is one of my favourite bits of the Old Testament. Listen to what God is saying here. This is bad business, but it's lovely. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. You that have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk, without money and without cost. Why do you spend your money on what is not bread, and your labour on what does not satisfy? Listen, listen to me, and eat what is good, and your soul will delight itself in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me, hear me, and your soul will live. I will make an everlasting covenant with you, my faithful love promised to David. So there is God, you know, saying the sort of words that lie behind this passage, saying, why do you spend your effort, your time, your money on that which does not satisfy? Come to me, I will give you the food, I will give you the milk, I will give you the water that will satisfy the heart. And then his complaint and his sort of lament over his own people Israel says this in the prophet Jeremiah: my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they have dug their own wells, broken wells that cannot hold water. And so what God is saying, there's a tragedy in the story. It's saying, God is saying, it's me that you're made for. But you not only walk away from me, you dig these other wells, which can, I think, satisfy for a time. Because I don't want to turn God into sort of the psychological, you know, the cosmic aspirin. But it does seem as if we're made for something bigger than just food and water and a house. The Australian dream, the house, the Honda and the holiday, sort of, used to be the Holden, but we've grown out of Holden now. Or the house and the Hyundai, if you like. But, you know, those sorts of, the Australian dream is a really good dream for an animal. I mean, the idea that if you've got food enough and you've got a place to live and you've got some friends, that should do you. That's a good dream for a dog. I mean, I like dogs. If I could find an excuse to get one, I'd like to get a dog. So, but doggies are happy with what? If they've got food in their bowl, water in their dish, a place to sleep, preferably inside, but if not, classically outside in the kennel. And they've got some friends to frolic with, humans will do. And when it's mating season, some animals to mate with. It's a perfectly happy dog. But frankly, that's pretty close to the Australian dream. And it works for a time. It works for a time. And sometimes, as you know, some of the quotes that we've brought here in various times come from people who've been magnificently successful. And they can no longer delude themselves that if I could just get this little bit more, then I would be satisfied. They've arrived. They've got everything they were told would work. And it hasn't worked. I shared last year that the comment of my older brother as we were driving around past Darling Harbour. He said, he's retired now, he's done really well as an engineer. He said, you do everything society tells you. You go to uni, you go to work, you buy a house, you get married, you have children. And now he's just retired, And he's just traveling the world, really. Just goes from lovely holiday to lovely holiday. He said, and now, and what? And the pals are not a very philosophic bunch, really. But it was interesting, he was basically saying, well, I've done it. And he's done it very well. And yet he's saying, kind of, really? That's it. And now basically, he's just filling in time till he dies. Now, he didn't put it that brutally, but he knows that. So he's done it, and I think he said, well, I thought there'd be more of a payoff. Because in the end, we're designed for a little more than just the dream of a dog. And so this Jesus says, I am the one who can give you the water. I am the one who can meet your deepest needs. And she finally says, I don't think she gets it, but at least she gets herself in the right attitude. She says, sir, give me this water so I won't have to come here and draw any more. So she's at least in the right position now. She's gone from saying to Jesus, what sort of weird Jew are you that jumps across all these social barriers and talks to me? What are you on about saying you can give me water and there's deep water? And she at least says, well, yes, I want it. Then Jesus continues on the same theme but seems to change the subject. He says, go and call your husband and come back. And this is a bit of a puzzle. He never does this anywhere else. Go and get your marital partner and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is that you've had five husbands, and the man that you have now is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you're a prophet. And just notice what happens there. They're talking about water. What is it that satisfies the soul? What is it that meets our deepest need? He then says, get your husband. She says, I have no husband. Is that the truth or a lie? Well, it's certainly a bit deceptive. Jesus nicely says to her, you're right. You've had five. The man you're living with now is not your husband. You have said truly. Now, just notice that Jesus does two things with her. Two things actually that go right back to chapter 1, verse 14, when John says, we've seen this guy, the Son of God, coming. We've seen his glory, full of grace and truth. And that's what we're seeing here with Jesus. You see it all over the place. He knows the truth about this woman. She has no secrets from him. They've never met. She knows that. He knows that. But he knows her deepest personal history, her sexual history. He knows it. And yet he is so gracious, isn't he? He could have said, you lying Samaritan whore. You know? And frankly, Jews of that day wouldn't have minded speaking like that to someone like this. They would just consider, I mean, she was a Samaritan woman with a history like that, in that culture. But he doesn't. He's very gentle with her. He lets her know that he knows her. But twice he says, you've spoken the truth. And only technically has she spoken the truth. What is Jesus doing? Well, there's a number of theories. Let me tell you what I think is happening. I think he's still talking about water. His theme is water. He's talking about what is it that satisfies the soul? Where do we find our deepest needs met? And one of the most common idols, which is where you take something which is good and a gift from God and you elevate it to a place where it's dangerous, is human love. Sexual, erotic, attraction, all the hopes that we have, in those sort of relationships, that's where she's been drinking from. And it hasn't kind of worked for her. She's got married five times. I mean, the amount of optimism there is there to come back for more. And it seems now she's given up, or maybe she can't convince anyone to marry her. So she's just taking living with the guy at the moment. But there's something beautiful about the way that Jesus reveals his grace and truth. He knows something. I don't need to remind you, I don't suppose, that he knows you. He knows me. He knows why we do things. He knows both our CV and the things we leave off our CV. But he knows also the fact that very often, unless you're made of different stuff to me, you can do good things for bad reasons. The clearest example I want to share with you, because it's long enough ago for it to be, you know, not all that revealing, is when I wanted more pocket money from my mother. She sort of ran that part of the family economy. I would bring her milk tea with two sugars and some toast in bed for about a week beforehand. And then I would ask for the pay rise. Can I have another threepence, please, in my etc. So what's happening is I'm being the absolutely perfect son, am I not? I'm bringing her tea in bed before she gets up and gets it for Dad, his black tea. And I'm doing it for what reasons? Utterly, ruthlessly selfish reasons. Pure self-interest, and yet it looks so lovely. And I was so, and she liked it, and she spoke so. I don't know, she's no idiot, my mother, so she probably worked the pattern out, I don't know. But she never turned on me and said, "You selfish little jerk, look at you. You know, behold yourself, look in the mirror." But in all sorts of ways, we do lovely things and nice things and say nice things and give money and forget our need to be loved and respected and esteemed, and all of that is exposed to Jesus. But the lovely thing with Jesus here, he's treating her as a needy, broken person. Not just as he could have if he wanted to be harsh and treat her as a, you know, subterfuging, dishonest person. I do think this woman is very Australian. She's quite feisty. I think she's quite flirtatious with Jesus. We can have that discussion some other time. I think she's enjoying the backwards and forwards. She's going to have a theological discussion with him, which we'll look at next week. Almost certainly the first theological discussion she's ever been allowed to have, because women, Samaritan women, immoral women from that culture, would not be engaged in theological debate, but Jesus has them with her in a few minutes. I think this woman is very Australian. She's feisty. She's not broken. She's hurting. She's ignorant of Jesus, she's interested in spirituality, but she's sexually messed up. She's sought fulfillment and water in the wrong place. And Jesus is calling her out of that. Stop drinking from the cesspool and the puddle. Stop looking for it from humans. It's just like two ticks sucking the life out of each other. Come to me, the host. I am the dog of life. And well, he doesn't quite say that. But he's saying, let me be the host from which you will find all that you need. Keep drinking or start drinking from where you need it. And that's what Jesus is doing here. And he says, it's as true as he says it to us. There was a quote sent to you, those of you who get the email, and they're quite fun to get, from the great Malcolm Muggeridge. Many years of his life an atheist. But he just says how the satisfaction he finds in Jesus far surpasses all the moments of satisfaction he had as a very highly esteemed and very wealthy and very successful BBC journalist. Lastly, so we've got some time for questions. It's very interesting, at the very beginning of this passage, this little word must pops up again in the original. It says here, verse 4, now Jesus had to go through Samaria. It's the word must, which is translated there as he had to go. He must go through Samaria. That's actually technically not true. Most Jews, if they wanted to go from Judea to Galilee, they would go around Samaria. They loathed each other so much, they would rather sort of travel twice the distance to avoid it. When it says he had to go through Samaria, the direct route, through the territory of the enemies, it seems almost certain that the must is the same as the other musts in this gospel. It's a God must. God has sent him to find this hungry woman. Because in the end, it's not us looking for God. We're looking for something when we stop and think and pause. But it's God looking for us. So Jesus has to go to Samaria to meet this woman, to set her free, to give her true water, and to bring him into life. And he does the same with us. He hassles and pursues and hunts us down patiently and gently. Here's two basic questions, I mean foundational questions. Is it known who wrote the book of John? If you go to the last and the second last chapter of John, John claims it's him, that John the beloved disciple, and all the early records of the Christians are that it's John. So one of the interesting things in this gospel is it talks about the beloved disciple. So, and if you read, if you look at the story, so John never gets mentioned in a lot of the stories, but there's a guy called Peter and Andrew and the beloved disciple, or the disciple that Jesus loved, which is, scholars are convinced, is John himself, one of Jesus' closest friends. So the claim is that it's an eyewitness. Which language was it written in? It was written in Greek, not the language Jesus spoke in, but it was what they call the lingua franca, a bit like in Africa, in East Africa. Everyone speaks their tribal language, and Swahili. A bit like in much of the world, people speak their own language in English now. It's the language that if you wanted to communicate widely, you spoke. It was a language of trade. And although it was the Roman Empire, it was on the background of the Greek Empire of Alexander, so they spoke Greek. So Jesus would have spoken probably three languages: Aramaic, the language of the people, Greek, and probably Hebrew. And there's four times in the Gospels where something from Jesus is actually said in the language he spoke it, and then it's translated. There's four times that the statements are so significant that the disciples record it in the language they heard it, then they give you the Greek translation. So will following Jesus cure all the existential angst in our lives? It seems some Christians are still anxious or worried or regretful. How does Jesus change things? Good question. Will following Jesus deal with all the existential angst in our lives? I think the way to look at it, the difference Jesus makes is this. I've got a very loud cough. I like Harley Davidsons, except when they're right outside when you're trying to... I think it's a Harley now. Jesus says, if you're thirsty, come to me and drink. I will satisfy you. I think the way to look at what Jesus does is not in some sort of absolute way, but the difference it makes to you. So that if you are born an anxious person and you get to know Jesus as he really is, your level of anxiety will be massively decreased and tamed. If you're born an unanxious person as I was, you just become dangerously optimistic, right? Knowing that God has all things in hand. And I think it's the difference Jesus makes. So I've seen some Christians, and I've shared this story once, stories I won't share before, guys who I found deeply disturbing in the way they treated their family in church. And then when I got to know their story, the fact that they were no longer in psychiatric prison was the miracle. And the difference, well, this one particular guy, he'd been in Morisset waiting, about to be sort of consigned to be there for almost indefinitely. He meets Christ through some old ladies who used to write letters. They'd always say, I'm not going to meet you ever. These old Christians would write letters to these prisoners, send them Bibles. This particular guy was in that group. He took it. He read it. He met Christ. He was released. He marries his de facto, adopts the children. And I remember meeting him out at Liverpool, and I said to Jim Ramsey, the minister, you've got to talk to him. He's so aggressive in the way that he talks to his wife. And he said, Ian, he told me about the story. So I think it's the difference Jesus makes. I don't think anyone arrives at nirvana, if I can use that silly word now, but it will make a massive difference to who you are. As you learn, it's learning, it's not just ticking the name Jesus, but it's actually getting to know him. Realizing here is someone who knows you like he knew that woman and yet loves you. And there's something very powerful about being known and loved, which is what Jesus brings. I have no secrets from him, and I don't need to keep any secrets. The reason why I don't want to tell even my wife some things about the way that I think is because it will be harder for her to hold me in such enormously high regard, which she still does, and I'm enjoying it. It's too good to let go of. But I need to keep secrets so you'll keep loving me, so that you'll keep respecting me. The great thing with Jesus is I can be completely honest and know that I'm loved enough for him to die for me. So he says, I've come that you may not be thirsty. The second last thing he says in John's Gospel before he dies is, I thirst. Which is very interesting because he keeps talking through the Gospels about, are you thirsty? Come to me. Is anyone thirsty? Come to me and drink. Second last thing he says on the cross is, I thirst. Where he is actually, he is being driven as he deals with our sin into our desert so that he can give us the abundance of knowing the love and the freshness of God. So it's knowing God in Jesus that deals with our anxieties, deals with our despair. But I think it's, you know, in terms of our life between now, you know, here's my life, 70 years, maybe I might get to 74 as my dad did, and then eternity. Made a massive difference here, which I was surprised about. But long term, the difference will be quite substantial.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.